Here we go. This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Scott Eichel, recorded on March 7th, 2014 at the University of Victoria Library, interviewed by Janelle Jazerski. All right. Do I have permission to conduct this interview?
Yes, you certainly do.
Excellent. I'm going to start with a couple background questions, just about your life in general. Where and when were you born?
I was born in a small Saskatchewan town just east of Regina called Indian Head, and that was 1940.
All right. And what did your parents do for a living?
They were farmers.
Both farmers? Okay. What was your educational background?
I did a Bachelor of Arts at the University of Saskatchewan, majors in history, English rather, and psychology. Mm-hmm. Went to work in the Air Force after that.
Great. What did you do any work before you enlisted?
Yeah, I worked every year to pay my way through. Mm-hmm. So I worked in cement plants, steel plants, pipelines, oil, mm-hmm. drilling rigs, all sorts of interesting things to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm. When did you enlist?
1963.
And what reasons?
Oh, I'd always wanted to be in the Air Force, and it's okay. Really too long a story to get into why, but I applied for military college in 1958 and was accepted as an engineer. I wanted to go air crew, so I went off and paid my own way through university. And after a couple of tries, false starts, again getting recruited for different trades that I wasn't interested in, I finally was recruited in Saskatoon as a air navigator radio officer, and went directly after all the 5 years of fussing around. Went directly into officer's candidate school.
Great. And would you like to help me understand your training experience?
Well, the first time round as a air navigator. We were in a common stream of Air RN, it was called Air Radio Navigator. And then halfway through a year, you were either selected or requested to become either a long-range navigator or a radio officer. And I asked to be a radio officer. And so I had another half year doing that. It was about a year-long course. And got my wings as a Air RN, RO as they were called. Mm-hmm. And went off to the operational training unit, and then on to a squadron. Mm-hmm. So it was a bugger. By the time everything was over, close to 2 years.
Okay. What was your first position in the RCF, and what?
Just a operational radio officer in the back of a P2V7 Neptune at Comox.
Okay. How long did you do that for?
I did that for about 2.5 years.
Okay.
And then I got sent off to be a flag lieutenant and aide to the Admiral, Commander of Maritime Forces here for a year.
And was that what you would consider your first major operation or role?
The operational role would just be as a crew a radio officer, just sitting in the back of the airplane doing electronic things. Mm-hmm. The year with the Admiral was, it takes you right out of the operational role and you have a completely different role. Mm. And then I applied for and was accepted for pilot training. So I wasn't an RO very long.
Okay.
Maritime operations, I had been on the West Coast here as a radio officer. On the East Coast, I was flying the Argus. And we just did regular maritime operations, surveillance, looking for submarines, some search and rescue, just general maritime operations, covers a lot of things. From that, after a 3-year tour doing that on a squadron in Greenwood, Nova Scotia, I was sent over to Summerside to what was called the Maritime Proving and Evaluation Unit. And we did operational test and evaluation of new equipment in the operational setup. We had two specially configured Arguses. One was an acoustic airplane with all sorts of new acoustic equipment. Mm-hmm. And the other was a remote sensing airplane with side-looking radar and ultraviolet sensors and infrared sensors and all that sort of thing. And we were the only two airplanes in the forces with all that equipment. And we flew both. Operation Brisk was one of the more interesting exercises in that it was a joint operation with the Royal Navy and with some scientists in England and Canada. The idea being to have a nuclear submarine, British nuclear submarine, HMS Sovereign, go under the ice up near Spitsbergen, transit over the north end of Greenland, and then up to the geographic North Pole, and then come back down out at Spitsbergen. And our job was to fly the track that we anticipated he would be going. And it was all cooperative, where there were scientists on board, there were one Canadian person on board the submarine, and sort of like people in the aircraft. And the submarine job was to, using sonar, to map the bottom of the ice pack. And our job was to fly over the same area about the same time and do infrared and side-looking radar scanning. So it was remote sensing. And what the scientists were hoping to do, and the military people, was to correlate somehow the surface of the ice with the underside of the ice. And during that exercise, the Slargus, as we call it, the remote sensing airplane, flew out of Thule in Greenland. And I had the acoustic airplane flying out of Sandstrom Air Force Base in the south of Greenland. And we coordinated our efforts, but we each had different roles. And as I confirmed this morning with the project officer on that, we both rendezvoused with the submarine at 84.53 north and 69.13 degrees west, just well up there. And interestingly, the submarine came up through a lead in the ice, an open space, or the Russians call it a polynya. And there he was, sitting in this open water. I remember it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was getting quite gloomy and sort of blue dark out, you know. The remote sensing airplane did his runs and did what he was supposed to do with the submarine. And then we came in and talked to the sub, and we did what was called a MAD run on him, a magnetic anomaly detection. I can explain that later, but it was a remote sensing type of device. And we got very low over the ice and did this pattern to track this guy. And then he said, well, I must be on my way. He was heading to the geographic North Pole. And we said, we'll try and track you as long as we can through the ice, because it could do that. And so he submerged, and it was one of the most, I think, spooky things I've ever seen. He disappeared, and all of a sudden the ice closed in where he had been, and it was as if there was nothing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles, nothing there, but he was underneath the ice. So we tracked him for a little distance. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. Went in the, we were given a record for it from Air Command at the time for the highest MAD mark. And
oh, really?
It was just more the commander of the Air Force. I think he was kind of joking a little bit. But anyway, it was very interesting and very significant exercise. The other airplane eventually, 6 days later, went up and did some further research work at the geographic North Pole. We came back to Canada. We were then advised that the submarine was missing. had not made a communications check. So it was just very upsetting. And Britain, the United States, and Canada got ready to go looking for that guy. And I was going to take a crew up to Iceland. But we, happy news came that the submarine checked in on UHF, which is a higher frequency radio. And it turned out that his regular communications antenna had been broken off in the ice. So he couldn't communicate. So he frightened everybody, but he was okay.
Good.
That submarine's now retired, just like the airplanes and the guys who flew them.
Wow, yeah.
So it was only one episode. It was not typical maritime operations at all. It was test and evaluation, and it was kind of off to one side for most things that we did.
Mm-hmm. What is a typical maritime operation?
Well, quite a classic one was the Russians regularly would send ballistic missile launching submarines down the coast to park off the United States mainly, but there was one used to park off Newfoundland. These things would come down regularly, and there were sensors that were able to pick up when they would come around the North Cape of Norway, and then the Norwegian Air Force would start tracking, and we'd lose them and can't find them. And then the British would pick up, and the Americans, as they came down through the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, called the GI-UK gap. And then Canada would get in on it, and we would work with the Americans off the east coast of Canada. And that was a pretty routine operation.
Okay.
And years later, interestingly, just a by-the-by, when the Cold War, the wall came down in Berlin, and we all started getting to know one another. Of course, the military people had bilaterals. I was at a reception in Ottawa, where the Russians, or Soviets, as they still were, sent over their Navy, Army, and Air Force people, and there was a Russian admiral came up to me and saw my uniform and said, "What did you do during the period that we were after one another?" I said, "Well, I was anti-submarine pilot." He said, "What did you fly?" I said, "I flew the Argus." He says, "I know the Argus very well." Turned out he'd been the skipper of one of these boats that used to sit off Newfoundland. And there we were looking for one another, and sometimes we found one another, sometimes
wow.
we didn't. So here we were having a cocktail together and kind of laughing about those days.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that's a long song and dance, Janelle, about. Mm. Surveillance, looking for submarines, cooperating with the British, Americans, Norwegians, mm-hmm. Dutch, all doing mostly anti-submarine work, but some surveillance of other things, and occasionally search and rescue thrown in.
I'm curious about what you said about search and rescue, because they have the specific search and rescue guys as well. So what did you do when you
were searching? Well, we couldn't do much rescuing, but mm-hmm. we could do searching. Okay. And for example, were coming home from we were at a proven evaluation unit, but we used to often do operational stuff too to keep current and try out our new equipment. We were coming back from Denmark, heading for Greenwood. Could do that in one trip, without landing. And we got a call from SUMAR, it was called. It was South Maritime Command in Plymouth in the UK, that there was a single-handed yacht race going on between Plymouth and Newport. Plymouth, England, Newport, Rhode Island. And there was a boat was going down, and so we just broke it off entirely and started looking for this guy. We never did find him. We knew we flew over him because he had a 50-foot boat, and the sea state was such that he was up in the spin drift on the top of the waves, and we never saw him. But the radar had him coming, had him going. We had to go away for fuel, but he was picked up by the by a container ship who was coming down the line that we had given. We could, using direction finding, tell where he was roughly, and the ship went down the line and picked him up. boat and all. We diverted to the Azores for gas. And on our way there, we heard a second mayday. The first guy was a Swiss boat yachtsman. The second guy was a German, and he was sinking too. But American Air Force picked him up, and they got to him. So, but we could find things, but we couldn't do much about it other than I can recall finding a Russian fishing fleet. They had a woman, a pregnant woman. They had fish factory trawlers, and she was in distress and needed help. So we went looking for the fleet, found it, found the boat that she was on, and then just orbited over top until the search and rescue people from who could bring helicopters and search and rescue technicians out.
Okay.
So so we could do that kind of thing, but it was essentially being helpful.
Okay, good. I wanted to ask you about your promotion to Major General, when that happened and how it affected your work.
It was 1989. I had been in the maritime world, and I got into the training business for a while, head of training, and then sent off to Ottawa for my first tour in Ottawa as a Brigadier General, which is a bit odd. To go in at that level, but and so I learned about all aspects of the Air Force and working in National Defense Headquarters, and after 1 year I was promoted to Major General and made be called Chief of Air Doctrine and Operations, so I was responsible for the air staff in Ottawa.
Okay, and what about the, you said you introduced the CP-140 Aurora?
Yeah, did that as a, I was this commanding officer of the training squadron. I'd been to the proving evaluation, went to staff college, came back as a commanding officer of the training squadron.
Okay.
And we had the Argus, and we were converting to the Aurora, CP-140 Aurora, which they still fly. And so I was given the honor and responsibility of heading the squadron that made that conversion. So my squadron flew the Argus and taught people in the Argus, and then we went off to learn to fly the Aurora with the Lockheed Company, and then we set up the training program to introduce it to the Canadian forces.
Okay.
So it was a pretty interesting time.
What impact do you think that had on just the Air Force in general?
It was critical. It was moving from analog to digital technology, and from 180 knots airspeed to we could at high altitude, we get up over 300 knots, and lower down, we routinely flew around well at 250 or more. So it doubled the speed. The technology change was very difficult to describe, because it literally was old analog equipment, which worked satisfactorily. And we had long legs with the Argus, but with the Aurora we could get places faster, and we had much more sophisticated equipment. So it was really, and other air forces were making that change at the same time. To stay in the game, you had to do it.
Was it difficult, the transition, especially for pilots who'd flown the analog for so long?
Actually, it's interesting, and that's a very good question, because I had many meetings with Lockheed, my counterparts in Lockheed. They were head of training within the Lockheed, with training for the Aurora. And they were all ex-Navy, American Navy pilots and air crew. And they asked that question. They said, do you think you guys are going to be able to make that transition? Because at 38 or 39 years old, you're starting to look a little long in the tooth for some of these things. And the navigators, who really were going to be working the equipment in the back, they were often in their 40s. So they were not old dogs learning new tricks, but kind of, you know. Anyway, the good news was that, in fact, the Lockheed guys were not skeptical so much as anxious that we could make that conversion. As it turned out, the pilots, it was pretty simple. The systems were analog. There were the 1950s style technology. The only difference was we had a little fancier instrumentation in some cases, and we had a CRT, so we could see what the navigators were doing, and our trick was not to get too focused on that and forget to fly the airplane. But other than that, it was easy for the pilots. Nice airplane to fly. The guys in the back had, they had the big challenge, and they, as they say, rose to the situation. I mean, they were really good, and they were guys in their late 40s, early to late 40s, a lot of them, and they made the conversion brilliantly, and Lockheed came to me after and said, we sure had you guys wrong. they said, well, if not, not the pilot so much. They were just really impressed with our navigators and equipment operators, how they made that transition.
Yeah. Oh,
that was very happy development.
Definitely a cool thing to be
it
part
was
of.
Very yeah. cool to be part of it, and to, because we were the first folks in the Canadian Forces to fly digital equipment. The F-18 mm-hmm. came right along. Mm-hmm. And they were able to capitalize on a lot of the experiences we had and mistakes we made. Mm. And they went from flying pretty cool fast stuff to flying pretty cool fast stuff with digital. Mm-hmm. You know? So, yeah, it was a very exciting time. It was about 19, well, I started the squadron, my job at the squadron in 78, and I left in 81. So it was mm-hmm. kind of over 1980. That all happened. And we trained every air crew in the maritime business off the Argus onto the Aurora in that period.
Can you think of any other technological advances that were new while you were maybe not as significant as the Aurora?
Well, you know, I guess we were a reflection of society, and it was, that was when things were really mm-hmm. starting to accelerate, you know. I couldn't point to a specific one, but all the systems that we were, communication systems. When I was first selected as an engineer, when I first applied in 1958, the military was looking way ahead, and they knew that there was going to be, I think it's not an overstatement to say, a revolution in communications and intelligence gathering and all the things, the infrastructure so important that underrests or underlies all of the actual military stuff. And they were looking to collect a whole bunch of, or train and educate a whole bunch of engineers who would become communications electronics engineers. CEs, we called them. But they, so the military was looking way down the road. So from 57, they were anticipating what was going to happen in the world, and it happened. So those guys then became the backbone of communications, of all sorts of intelligence infrastructure and things. Mm. So I wasn't particularly involved in that, mm-hmm. but we were surrounded by it. Cryptography and communications particularly. I bashed a key when I joined as a radio officer, literally.
Yeah.
With an old key. And by 1980s, we had machines that you typed things, and it would all be encrypted and all managed transparently to the operator. Quite something.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
I suppose we could talk about the first Gulf War, mm-hmm. your involvement in that.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned a little earlier, I guess the sort of responsible for the Air Force staff in Ottawa, the operational staff and training staff and all that sort of thing. I had training, operations, doctrine, policy, all Air Force stuff. My direct superior was also Air Force. He could have been Navy or Army and often was, but mine happened to be Air Force, so I worked closely with him. Became commander of Air Command, but we sort of, it wasn't that we worked hand in glove, but we worked hand in glove, if you know what I mean, that I had the staff and he had responsibility for all operations in the Canadian Forces. So I had the air side of that. And it was a lot of hard work, long hours. Everybody was doing it, you know. But it was almost, there was not sort of the highly charged atmosphere you see in the movies. You know, it was very kind of businesslike and workmanlike, and everything being done by those communication systems that I was telling you about, that we could talk to people in Northern Region or in NORAD headquarters in Colorado. We talked to you could talk to people in the Gulf. I didn't do that. I would send memoranda. It was before emails, actually. Jeez, it's the only game, too. But I would send memoranda and go to meetings, and we would make decisions collegially. And nobody sort of waved their hands around and said, do this, do that, do the other thing. It was a very cooperative, collegial, bureaucratic in a lot of ways, but it seemed to have worked.
Yeah.
And what was my role in it? Well, it was just to be part of that team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of what impact you were having during that time or afterwards in the overall picture, or did it seem like just more part of your job?
It was not routine. Mm-hmm. It was not a routine thing in any sense, because people were being hurt or killed. Fortunately, none of our Air Force guys, but you know, there were people, or the humans were losing their lives, and there was a lot of damage being done. What was my impact on it? It was almost, I was able to kind of set myself aside from it and be part of it without internalizing it, mm-hmm. if you like. Maybe that's an ambiguous answer for you, but I didn't have any sense of drama, particularly, and I don't know if anybody else did, maybe some do, did. But really, it was just plain hard work,
yeah,
getting things done. Stuff like finding a way to get our jets from Europe down to the Gulf when certain allies wouldn't let us overfly. So our jets had to fly all down the Bay of Biscay and around through the Mediterranean, and they were not universally supported by some other countries. So cooperatively with the British, we arranged for British tankers to tank them on the way. Things like that. Those were kind of the exciting moments when you could pick up the phone and call a colleague in the Royal Air Force, for example, and say, can you help us? Yes, it'll be done. So that's when things were kind of done quickly. Other times, a great deal of the really interesting cooperation was done not by generals, although we always, you know, get mixed up in things, but a lot of it was done at the major and captain level. The deals, swaps, and things got done. Equipment moved around, and they said, we'll worry about the invoicing later. And that was done by quite junior officers. Mm. So that was kind of interesting to watch. I'm not sure they always told all of us everything we were doing.
Is there any significant difference, you think, in the sense of when you were doing your work compared to, you know, the first Gulf War, when it was combat and it was during a war, and then other times when you were just kind of doing general maritime operations, either in hindsight or
at the time? Yeah, no, the Gulf War thing, it didn't last very long, remember. It was over in a heartbeat, thankfully. Mm-hmm. But it was really intense, whereas the regular maritime operations, I was working at a completely different level, too. Mm-hmm. Could be very intense in some cases, but it was peacetime. The Gulf thing, and I think a lot of people had perhaps a bit of difficulty hoisting in that it was a war going on, and there were people losing lives. But to compare the two of them, there were similarities in intense exercises in peacetime, but it just, if anybody lost their lives, it was an accident.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Can you describe any of these intense exercises?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there used to be a lot of them, you know, big cooperative exercises. We used to go down to, from the East Coast, now taking back to being just a regular squadron guy. We used to go down to Puerto Rico once a year and down to Bermuda once a year. It sounds pretty nice, actually, and even the airplanes liked it, you know. They flew well in warm weather. But yeah, we go down for stretches and just work operations, and it was busy, you know. You worked around the clock, and there were good times, good memories, and some not so good. We lost an Argus down there one year. It was before I joined, but I had a childhood or school friend who was killed in that thing, and so these things happen, but there were accidents. Mm-hmm. But pretty intense sometimes.
Yeah. What kind of things were you doing in these exercises?
Well, there was a lot of stuff going on, but primarily what our job was to, they would have American and Canadian submarines as mechanical rabbits for us, and we would have areas set out, and they would have to find their way around from one point to another in there, and we were to catch them. And sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. But that could get intense. You know, you'd actually, if you found one of them, you had to put in a simulated attack on them, and with little smoke charges and stuff like that. But it was always training, you know, rather than any real shooting. Mm-hmm. But the there's some great tough exercises, and some really interesting things happened. I knew a lot of people, both on the surface ships, in the trackers and helicopters, in the Argus, and in the submarines. Another guy that I had played football with in high school, different teams, was a submarine commander down there. And I knew whenever he was doing his thing that we had our hands full. He was a pretty smart fella. And, it was just really interesting to know the guys on the other side, a good many of them.
So you guys were often working with other air forces, correct?
And other navies, too.
And other navies. Yeah. What was the relationship, you think, between what you would learn in these exercises from the other air forces and vice versa?
Well, first of all, there was always, pardon me, there was always competitiveness. I mean, there was competitiveness within the squadrons. The Americans, maritime airmen like us, were actually in the Navy. The British and the Canadians were Air Force. The Dutch were Navy, Germans were Navy, Norwegians were Air Force. So, first of all, you had the Air Force Navy thing, which is always, it can be a humorous competition, or you can get people get carried away. But we had a lot of good times with these guys. Well, what did we learn from them? Particularly, we worked with the American Navy an awful lot, and they had some excellent people. And a big operation and great equipment. Our Aurora was actually a step ahead of their airplane by just a little bit, but a step ahead. so they were able to pick up some things from us. Our equipment was slightly more modern. A lot of the stuff that we learned was just in briefings and debriefings where we were sitting with them. Just talking informally with them, you get ideas. I mentioned the submarine commander that I had played sports with or against. He had certain tactics. He knew the minds of pilots and what we liked to do and what we didn't like to do. And he would sail his submarine in such a way when he was trying to get away from us that he would capitalize on tendencies that we had as pilots. And he never told me that directly, but I found out that that was how he operated. And of course, then I was able to, from other people, informally. So we were able to take that into account. And rather than doing things perhaps the way we had always done it, according to the manual, you get inside the mind of the other person if you have some insight into that. no matter how you get it. Turn that right back on to them. So it was a mind game as well as a tactical robotic type of exercise. I don't mean to overstate that, but it was not trivial. There was a human element that was quite interesting.
How do you describe the relationship between the Air Force and the Navy? Obviously, they're working in close quarters very often.
There used to be, when I first joined, there was a lot of competition between the two of them, and sometimes quite ill feeling at certain levels. By the time I left the forces, I saw very little of that. It might have been, you know, some people just never get over their prejudices and on both sides of the fence. But for most of us, I think it was just a really cooperative thing. A good number of my friends in the city are Navy, and we don't hash that stuff over too much anymore. But there were always prejudices and biases and name calling. I mean, in a funny sort of way, we called them anchor clankers. They called us crab fats, you know, and zoomies and stuff. But by and large, we get along pretty well.
Yeah. What about on a tactical and operational level?
Good. Really good. Yeah. Well, I'll give you an anecdote, and you can do what you like with it. There's a retired vice admiral in town here, Admiral Brodeur, whose family is famous in the Navy. His grandfather, everybody was an admiral. And Admiral Brodeur was the captain running a big exercise off Bermuda a few years ago. Well, I was an Argus captain. He was a four-ring captain. I had two rings a long time ago. And he came along to ride with us to see what it was like in the air. And very quiet, he listened and watched what was going on, and he finally realized that, first thing he said was, "I can't imagine you guys listening to all those networks, radio nets." You know, they often, the Navy would have maybe one guy listening to one net and another one listening to another. We listened to everything. and still flying the airplane. He thought that was pretty interesting. Well, and then talking to one another. Well, we called up the operational commander of the little Navy group that we were working with and asked for instructions. We were just orbiting around waiting for instructions. And they said, "Stand by. Stand by, stand by." It went on for probably 20 minutes or more. They just said, "We'll get around to you," sort of thing. Meanwhile, we're burning a lot of gas and just motoring around. Well, this admiral, or then Captain Brodeur, came up to me. He'd been listening to this. He came up to me and he said, "I'd like you to send a message to that fellow down there and tell him your call sign. Give him my call sign." He said, "We're famished," was the expression you used. "We're famished. We're looking for something to do here." And he said, "You can use my call sign when you tell it." We had instructions, elaborate instructions, in no time at all. We were sent all over the place. We were suddenly critical to the operation. And that was a classic case. And then he stood up at the big debrief in Halifax after, and he told the story. He said, "I don't want to ever see that again, where you have an Argus and a whole crew of people just parked off waiting for something to happen." He says, "You get busy and employ them." So it was great. And the Navy took the lesson, and the Air Force people all puffed their chests out. And he and I still are friends, you know, cordial friends. Then we tell that story. He and I will tell that story better. So it's an anecdote, Janelle, but it's representative of how things could be. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the unification of the forces had any significant impact on the relationship between the Navy and the Air Force, either operational, tactical, or personal?
It was a pretty upsetting time for everybody. There was some rationale behind it. Integration, people mix up integration and unification. Unification was just what the Defense Minister Hellyer at the time wanted. He envisaged something like the United States Marine Corps, where you were all brothers of the same and sisters of the same uniform, even though they had different arms. That was not useful. we were not the United States Marine Corps, and he ill understood the situation. He had some prejudice from the Second World War. He had seen things he didn't like, and he thought, well, I'll not let that happen. Anyway, so he had his reasons. What would have been useful was integration of logistics, supply, communications, all those things with subsets particular and peculiar to the individual Navy, Army, and Air Force. But it was often happens in these things when you get a bureaucratic setup originated by politicians and others, some of whom are well-meaning, sometimes the dish runs away with a spoon, and that's what happened. So we went too far, and we've ratcheted back ever since. Whether that's all good or not, I don't know. But the impact was initially shock and dismay and disbelief in some cases, and then sort of a recovery and get on with it type of thing and make the best of it. And that's happened over time. People will find a balance. You know, the pendulum sometimes stops in the middle. Well, I was actually flag lieutenant to the admiral the day that came in. So here I was, a flight lieutenant in the Air Force as an aide to an admiral, and that was upsetting for a lot of the Navy people around here. Confusing for me, desperate situation for the admiral because I had no clue what I was doing. But anyway, I got a phone call from the head of a big training school here, a commander, the morning that happened. He called me up and he said, "Flags, what do I call myself this morning?" He had been a commander. I said, "Sir, I don't know, but I think you're a lieutenant colonel now." I thought he was going to come apart. But, you know, that was the not cosmetic, that was the surface of the problem. But underneath, people got the job done, and we all wore different colored uniforms for a while, and things are kind of normalized a bit again, and we'll see. Short answer to your question about the impact of unification was it was dramatic, really dramatic, and caused a lot of, I think, in my view, unnecessary effort by people to compensate for what was not a good idea necessarily. Integration, maybe. Yes, in fact. Unification wasn't going to work, and it hasn't. And we're no longer unified as such.
That was going to be somewhat my next question, if you think there were any advantages at all, or if over time some advantages have come to light with doing that.
Yeah, sure. Well, the integration of communication, supply, and all that sort of thing, a lot of the infrastructure issues, this below the combat level sort of thing, you know, the warfighting level of the forces, there's a huge underburden of activity that goes on, but a good deal of which, and it would take an expert for a good answer for this, but a good proportion of that is best done by people working hand and glove together, you know, no matter what color their uniform is. You may be aware, the helicopter guys, the Sea King guys, a lot of them are, well, they're Air Force people now, working hand and glove with the Navy, and there are people who are aviators, and then there are people in those squadrons who are logistics types, supply types, mechanics, and everything else, who could come from anything, you know. And so that was actually, there were some good things came out of it, really. After the shock was over, there were some really good things came out of it, but the basic idea went too far,
okay,
in my view.
Was there one particular aspect of your job that kept you in the forces for so long?
Airplanes.
You just love it.
Yeah, I just loved airplanes.
Yeah. That's good. Did you work with a lot of women?
Not initially. Women didn't have a large presence. I joined in 63. Mm-hmm. And they were not a large presence. But as years went on, it kind of became a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I got out, there was still not a lot of female air crew, for example, and I I may be wrong, I don't think there are any combat soldiers who are women, but even that's been set aside. Mm-hmm. So did I work with a lot of women? Yeah, I did. Not operationally in the early stages, more so as time went on, and now it's kind of transparent. The detachment commander and on the Hell Air Dept has just gone off to the Middle East as a woman.
Was there any, because, yeah, I asked because you were in the forces during that transition from they really didn't have any role to an increasing
truly
role.
Truly expanded. Mm-hmm. And that, interestingly, went beyond people in uniform. It touched our wives, spouses, friends. Mm-hmm. Literally, my generation spanned from the old days, not necessarily the good old days either, mm-hmm. but the old days to what is going on now. And it's really quite fascinating how that happened. And so by the time I was gone, though, in 1994, seems like only yesterday, mm-hmm. there's been so much happened. I worked with a lot of women. Paula Skippen, who's part of your... she's one of the prime movers behind the relationship with Rusi from UVic. Paula was a director general in defense. She was not in uniform, but I remember having dealings with Paula back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So, but the women tended to show up more in civilian positions of responsibility in NDHQ.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What would you say overall impact of your experience in the forces has had on your life?
I'd go back and do it again. I'd make some changes in hindsight, but mm-hmm. I'd do it again. And as everybody said, when all else, when you forget just about everything else, you remember the people you knew. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the people I knew in the service were some of the finest. Mm-hmm. I sound like I'm preaching now, but they were wonderful, wonderful characters. My era, the Cold War era, mm-hmm. is an interesting time in that, as I mentioned earlier, if anybody lost their lives or was injured, it was an accident. Mm-hmm. Probably the gentlest time to be in the military in many, many years in Canada. I mean, the people nowadays are... They have risks that we never had, mm-hmm. as did the Korean War folks and the Summer of War guys. So it was an interesting time to be in. I'm glad I had a part of it. Hope I made my contributions properly, but it was a good time. Other than that, I'm really glad that this program that you're involved mm-hmm. in is going on. Particularly, the Canadian forces are more front and center in people's minds now. Mm-hmm. But back during the Cold War, we were from the other side of the moon. People just, there was actually quite a, even though we represented the society we were part of, there was a chasm between the public knowledge or interest in the forces. And we kind of sat off and did our own thing and did the best we could to relate. Public relations was one of your big challenges, trying to get the word out. But no, what you folks are doing is, I think it's great.
Do you think that is still present today?
That chasm?
Yeah.
It is with some people, mm-hmm. But much less. I mean, there's always something going on. The press stoke a lot of it, The experiences from the Gulf War and Bosnia, which was a terrible, terrible time, and it gets almost no reference at all now, mm-hmm. but it was awful. And they talk about PTSD. Mm-hmm. I was in the personnel world at that time, as chief of personnel careers and stuff, and people were really being hurt psychologically with the things they saw in the Balkans. And that seems to have been kind of forgotten, in favor of Afghanistan, which they saw terrible things there. So to the extent that the public takes an interest in the forces and pays a little more attention to some of these folks that really have done more than their share, I think that's good. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it takes wars and bad things for that to happen.
Do you think people are losing touch with the war and these things that happened? A lot of, especially young people, there's a lot of peace movements and whatnot. Do you think that impacts at all the chasm once again?
What you folks are doing is one of the things that can go some distance towards bridging that. You mentioned the peace movements. You know, good thing for the peace movements, as our former chief of defense staff used to say, I'm a part of the peace movement too, just a different branch. Mm-hmm. You know, but I know what you're referring to, and you know, that's part of the privilege of living in an open society like this, mm-hmm. that you can have people who vehemently disagree with one another, and they don't have to take a stone up and start throwing it. Mm-hmm. You know, so but you will always have people. I have friends, well-educated, intelligent people in this city, never mind everywhere else, and they're still, as they meet some of the former service people and get to know us a little bit, say, you know, we just had no idea what kind of people you were or are. Mm-hmm. and I don't mean it patronizing, they're just kind of stunned, you know. That chasm existed, and they are very open about saying they had no idea mm-hmm. about any of the stuff that we were doing and were doing. But there will always be that. There are some people who just viscerally associate any form of authority, let alone military, any form of authority, they associate it with something bad, mm-hmm. whether it's the police or you name it, particularly the police and the military, were kind of lumped together as... not all that bright and tend to be aggressive and unpleasant people. Well, that's just, some people have that in their head, and that's the way it is. Mm-hmm. And you can't change it unless there's some sort of a epiphany that they go through through some experience. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it's quite widespread. Mm-hmm. Quite right. And it's been there all along. Mm-hmm. Probably less now than it was back in the Cold War, because at least there's a human face on the military now. Lots of people in places like Campbell River and Comox and Courtney and all over the towns here know somebody who served in Afghanistan or something. Mm-hmm. And so they say, well, you know, that's not what we thought. Or, there's a human face, which there wasn't back in the Cold War mm-hmm. thing. It was very difficult to get a human face on what we were doing. It was all theoretical. It was... mutually assured destruction was MAD, as it was called, with the Russians and the Americans, or Warsaw Pact and NATO, sitting there glowering at one another. That's pretty hard to explain mm-hmm. to people.
Yeah. Did you feel under-recognized while you were in the forces?
Yeah, it didn't bother me. Yeah. And it didn't really puzzle me mm-hmm. either, because you could understand why that was the case.
Unless you have any other...
No, I think that's good, Janelle. Yeah.
Okay. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Scott Eichel on March 7th, 2014. We have both signed the interview release form, is that correct?
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was going to tell you about...